honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, launching Filipino-American History Month through the memories of two men who easily could have perished on the Bataan Death March, but both found a way to avoid that fate. A reminder, check out the Filipino-American History exhibit this month aboard the USS Hornet Sea, Air, and Space Museum in Alameda, California. Let's get back to the story of Atilano David, who, after escaping the Bataan Death March, operated with guerrilla groups trying to undermine the enemy while the Philippines were occupied by Imperial Japan.
Number one, while the spying was operating, we were able to relay to Australia through a smuggled radio the compliments that came in, how many warships, how many airplanes, how many airfields, how many troops. We were able to impart this to Australia, which was related to MacArthur. And what I'm proud of is really that the Filipinos never surrendered to the luring of the Japanese to become one of them. We were too ingrained with American culture, and we considered the Japanese as second-class citizens to us. So we never really assimilated with them. But in fairness to them, they were not all demons. They were educated officers who took care of the sick and who took care of the... Even on the death march, there were Japanese soldiers who gave food to the starving. Stealthily, they gave food to soldiers who were about to fall. So they're not, humanity is complex. One thing that really scared the hell out of me, after I escaped on the beheading of my people in the spiring, I was at Baguio eating my family from the boondocks. I found a Ford wagon to transport my family. My family was my oldest brother was deaf mute. My two brothers, we had sacks of rice, and I didn't know it was contraband. So we were stopped midway between where I took my family from the boondocks to Manila. We were stopped, and a soldier poked his knife, his bayonet, into the stock, and rice came out. So they tied my hands behind my back and took me to the camp. And there was a stump, a tree cut. And they laid my head on the block, and I prayed, and I was almost fainting. I knew this was the end. And then the officer came with his sword. He said, "Quah!" Something that he exclaimed. And then they started laughing. It was a big joke. I was so mad, but I could only cry. I could only cry. And everybody was laughing. They had a good laugh at my expense. And my deaf mute brother tried to attack them, but he was held back. When they found out that he was deaf mute, they ignored him. I think that was the scariest time of my life.
Well, I think everyone listening is saying the same thing. They tie your hands behind the back, walk you to a stump, stick your head on it, and draw a sword. So obviously they're going to cut off your head. That's what you're thinking. You said you prayed. What do you pray in a moment like that?
I just prayed Our Father, and that's it. I kept saying Our Father. Because they held me in suspense for a bit. Anyway, when it was over, I was shaken up, and I was sweating, and I could not, because I was driving the van, I couldn't drive anymore. They just put me in the back and lay down.
And I don't want to gloss over anything, so feel free to jump in with any other circumstances that are real memorable to you. But when the Americans returned and were able to recapture all that land and claim the Philippines, what did that mean to you, to your family, to the other Filipinos that you knew? How big a deal was that?
Apparently, it's quite a big deal, because we were all skinny from lack of food. And we were in the boondocks, and there was no food but chickens and vegetables. And when I was in the boondocks, suddenly I was paddling a canoe to bring some tomatoes and some spinach, lettuce to my family, and some chicken and eggs. A piper cub came roaring over the treetops and dropping leaflets. And the leaflet said, "I have returned." I didn't waste any time. I took my supplies to my family, got them fed, explained that I had to leave. I don't know when I'll be back. So I was excited. I paddled my canoe through the Pampanga River and got to Palit in Manalin, where I docked my canoe. And I passed. It was in the backyard of a fabulous mansion. It was empty because it was wartime. As soon as I got on the road was dirty and musty and dusty, and everything was covered with brown dust. And then the tank came up. After several troop carriers and tanks came by, I finally flagged one tank, and he got me in. This name is Sergeant James Bell. He was the first guy who was killed in Korea, in top of his tank, writing to his wife. Anyway, he took me in, and he got me to Camp Olivas, where MacArthur was, February 5. So I gave them my dog tag and my record, and they started the 201 file. And right away, I wanted to join the attack on University of Santo Tomas to liberate the 2,500 prisoners. I was refused for some reason or other, because I think because I was skinny, skin and bones. But anyway, Sergeant Bell, we became friends, took me to his tank. We got into his tank, and he showed the movie of them when they had invaded the Philippines, and they showed Japanese from hideouts, caves, coming out burning in flame from the flamethrowers. And my feeling was, I was not animosity. I just felt, I said, humans being burned alive. I was shaken. And I told my friend, "No more. I don't want to see anymore," because he wanted to show me all his exploit from Leyte, island to island, to Luzon. And he showed me nothing but burning soldiers, flamethrowers. So anyway, we became friends. As a matter of fact, I still have his pictures.
Have you ever considered how different things would be in your homeland if the Allies had not found victory over the Japanese?
We did. We considered we were getting settled to the point that the U.S. had abandoned us, and that although we were facing years and years of Japanese occupation, we were getting adjusted to it, excepting for the atrocities, because their singular ordinary form of punishment is to slap you in the face. To them, that was nothing. Because they live with it. And then to the extreme cases where whole villages were massacred. In one town, this was when they learned that the Americans were coming, they lured a whole village into the church, promising them rice and food. And when they locked the church, they set it on fire. And when the door broke down from the fire, the villagers came out and they were shot by machine gun fire. So there were at least about 200. An eyewitness saw that, but he was not in the church.
I can't imagine what that's like to watch that happen. Is that anger or rage or just heartbreak?
At that point where we were already used to hunger and starvation and getting used to deprivation, when we used to be a prosperous nation, we got adjusted. This was rage against the Japanese.
And you said you volunteered to go on the raid of the San Tomas prison camp, and they didn't take you there. But when that eventual victory was reached, when you heard that the Japanese had surrendered, what did that mean to you after everything you'd been through?
By this time, I was assigned to Philippine Army or USAFI headquarters. I was screening insurance forms for GIs in Philippines, and I was also part of the group that was screening guerrillas to find out if they are bona fide guerrillas or just fake guerrillas, which were many. Yeah, they were guerrillas only for one day, but they had many signatures. So I was one of those who screened them, and I happened to published a mimeograph newsletter for the headquarters called Camp Murphy newsletter. And I was there. I scooped several American editors for Stars and Stripes because I was the first one to mention the surrender. I had interviewed and taken notes from these populace who were just shooting guns into the air and just getting drunk with happiness the PJ Day. I found out later that two of those editors who I scooped on this newsletter was one of the became the editor of Los Angeles Times, and the other one was Chicago Times. And that was my role. After the surrender, I began to just lead the life of a enlisted man in the headquarters, doing what I could.
That wasn't the end of your journalistic days, though. How was it that you ended up working with Edward R. Murrow?
When I first arrived in the States, I couldn't find a job, but because I enrolled in Columbia U for film production, TV and film production, they made me an intern. What I was to do was write his news copy from the teletype machine in 25 words or less. So I did that. So later on, I was never one to remain too long in a place. I joined Macy's. I became a advertising copywriter.
What was it that you did with Murrow?
I did summarize the copy that he spoke on the anchor schedule.
You wrote what he read?
I wrote what he read. I edited the teletype copy.
What was he like to work with?
He was a nice person, but he was outspoken. And when I shared this bathroom, it was carpeted with cigarette butts. He was a strange chain smoker whenever you saw him. And then I finally gave up sharing his bathroom. I had to go to the common bathroom across the hall. But he was a very nice person.
When you think back about what you did and what you went through during World War II, what are the things that you're most proud of and most thankful for?
I'm proud of having fought the Japanese with the Americans because we were under the rule of the Spaniards' cruel sovereignty for 300 years and 200 years with America. So we were Americans at heart. In fact, if you went all the way to the boondocks, you could have got away with English. They spoke English. But I'm proud of the idea that I fought for the U.S., I fought for the Philippines. And my sense of adventure gave me enough pride to write about the heroes, which I am concluding now. And I've been here in the States where I have seen everything. I've seen discrimination here, but I have seen also how good most of my friends and buddies here in the States are Americans, and they have been close buddies for at least 25 years.
You talk about writing about the heroes. Who are the heroes in your eyes?
My hero is the one who substituted for me on my scouting expedition and died for my assignment, because I would have died there. And my heroes also is General Wainwright and General King. Because without General King, we would have died on the front just from starvation. Or because we were too weak to fight, they would have killed us because they didn't take prisoners. So I'm proud of the fact that I'm an American. I became a citizen in 1973, my wife and I.
You mentioned that you had tried to find that family, De La Cruz, that you talked about that had harbored you and saved your life. I wonder, too, about those men who pushed you into the ditch, into the bushes. Did they survive the march? Did you ever find out?
No, because on the march, 12,000 Filipinos died in 35 miles, and 6,000 Americans died in 35 miles, and then another 1,000 every day at the camp. So they were probably one of those, because they were also starving and thirsty. I've never heard of them.
Do you ever ask yourself why? Why me? Why did all these things happen at the right time so I could survive? And if so, what's your answer?
Somebody up there likes me. St. Peter is not ready for me yet. Yeah, and I've had the close escapes even in civilian life. I'm still here.
You're still here, still going strong. And one of the things you've done in more recent years is you designed a memorial to those who suffered and died on the Bataan Death March. Tell me about that memorial, what inspired it, and how people can see it.
Well, I remember a Filipino wife extending a ladle of water to two soldiers, one American, one Filipino, and that stuck in my mind. So one day I was already in Orlando. I was publishing my own magazine in Orlando. Somebody came one day knocking at my door, and he said, "Are you Talano David?" "Yes," I said. "We have learned that you know how to draw and how to paint. That's one of my paintings there." I said, "Yeah. Well, we would like you to draw a concept of a memorial, and I want you to draw what you remember." So I drew a Filipino woman giving aid to two guys. Then they made a sculpture out of it, and they made a bronze life-size statue and put it in the front of Lake Kissimmee in Kissimmee, Florida, which is about 3 or 4 miles south of Disney World. And at the inauguration, I was the guest speaker for having designed that thing. And I had a Filipino general and an American general as guest speakers. I probably made a very good speech because the generals, the two of them, has asked me for a copy so that they could use it in their own gatherings. So I was kind of complimented on that. And then they told me that my drawings will be in a time capsule to be opened in 100 years beneath the statue. Wow. It's now a tourist thing. It's life-size, facing the lake.
I know you can't recite the whole speech from memory, but if they complimented you on the speech and said it was so great, I'm sure people at home are saying, "Well, what did he say?" Do you remember what the crux of your presentation was and what it was you were trying to express?
Well, the thing that made women cry in the audience was when I said, "This memorial is to honor your brothers and sisters, uncles and sons, and they are still with you, sitting beside you, celebrating this occasion." There was one who fainted, and they told me about it. So I was kind of flattered because, somebody from the Boondocks in the Philippines here in the United States making Americans cry. These are the things that I remember as my years are going by. I am so happy that there's now a move to recognize all the veterans living or dead here in Albuquerque or California or Texas. And I just learned that there's a move which is gathering strength about the recognition of Filipinos who were not recognized properly. In fact, they were denied benefits at one time. I feel that at last we are given the recognition we deserve.
Which is certainly the sentiment behind Filipino-American History Month this October. There's more information for you to explore along with the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have on the radio today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.